Lecture 3, A Goddess and a Princess.
Welcome back to Lecture 3. In our previous lecture, we discussed Xenia and its importance both in the Telemachy and for the Odyssey as a whole. In this lecture, we're going to turn to Odysseus himself as a character in the Odyssey. We'll examine Odysseus's first appearance in Book 5 and his interaction with the goddess Calypso, and then move on to talking about his encounter in Book 6 with the Phaeacian princess Nausicaa. The lecture will concentrate on the aspects of Odysseus's character that are foregrounded in these two books, specifically his desire to return home as a desire to reestablish his own identity and his superb skill at rhetoric and at persuasive speech. Finally, we'll discuss the ongoing thematic importance of Xenia in Nausicaa's welcome of Odysseus in Book 6. Now, Book 5 opens with a restatement of the gods' plans for Odysseus. At this point, it makes very good sense for the bard to restate exactly what Odysseus's situation is. This has been established in Book 1, and we had seen Athena tell Zeus it's time to send Hermes to make Calypso let Odysseus go. But, of course, that bit of Book 1 was 4 hours ago in performance time, if you imagine the bard reciting the Odyssey steadily over the intervening 4 books that we've discussed in the last lecture. So at this point, at the opening of Book 5, the bard recaps for us where Odysseus is, what his situation is, and we get another scene in which Athena once again reminds Zeus, send Hermes to Calypso's island, tell Calypso to let Odysseus go. And at this point, we get that scene of Hermes going to visit Calypso, which we would have expected from the opening of Book 1, but which was then put on hold for the 4 books of the Telemachy. Zeus sends Hermes to Calypso's island and tells Calypso, through the agency of Hermes, that she must let Odysseus go. Our first view of Odysseus himself comes when Calypso goes to take him Hermes' message. Now, remember, at this point, Odysseus has been held captive on Calypso's island for 7 long years. All his companions, all the men who went to Troy with him, are long lost. We'll follow the story of how he came to lose all his companions when we talk about books 9 through 12. At this point, Odysseus has been held as a solitary prisoner for 7 years. And our first view of him, he is sitting by the seashore, looking out over the water and weeping. And we're told that he does this every day, that he spends all his days gazing out over the ocean, longing for a sight of Ithaca and crying. In Book 1, when Athena first mentioned Odysseus to Zeus, she said that Odysseus was longing to see even the smoke rising from his own country, to glance even catch even a glimpse of smoke rising from Ithaca, and that he wanted to die. This is how we see him in our first view of him in Book 5. And this sense of profound longing and helplessness on Odysseus's part, in a way, is an indication that Odysseus is, as long as he's on Calypso's island, very unlike himself, in a sense, not Odysseus at all. On Calypso's island, Odysseus is largely passive. There's nothing he can do. He cannot get away from her. There's no one to help him. His wits will not help him here. He can't contrive a scheme, come up with a plan to get away. He is enforcedly passive, and a passive Odysseus is scarcely Odysseus at all. He is completely unlike his true self as long as he's on Calypso's island. It's probably not coincidental that Calypso's name literally means I shall hide or I shall conceal. Calypso is the goddess who conceals Odysseus from the world, but in a sense conceals the real Odysseus even from Odysseus himself. He is, as long as he's on her island, unable to act, unable to plan, thus in a kind of limbo, in a kind of state between real existence and death. As soon as Calypso tells Odysseus that he may go, that she's decided to let him go, we see him start to exhibit character traits that will be his hallmark throughout the rest of the Odyssey. Once he's told there is an action that you can take, he reasserts his essential self and starts to become Odysseus again. In this first interaction with another character that we see in the audience, in the Odyssey, in his conversation with Calypso, the bard sets up several crucial points about Odysseus's character and, as so often, about underlying themes of the Odyssey. First off, one of the hallmarks of Odysseus's character throughout the Odyssey is his caution. When Calypso comes to him as he's sitting on the seashore weeping for his lost homeland and says, "I've decided to let you go home," Odysseus does not immediately jump up, say, "Great, lead me to a ship or a raft or something. Let's go, let's get started on arranging for my homecoming." Instead, he's cautious. He makes Calypso swear that she's not plotting some trick against him. He makes her swear a great oath by the river Styx, which is the inviolable oath of the gods. When the god promises something by the river Styx, the god is bound by that promise. Odysseus makes Calypso swear by the river Styx that she is not tricking him, not planning to hurt him, not scheming something to harm him. So his caution is foregrounded here in his very first interaction with another character in the Odyssey. Another very important point that comes out in his interactions with Calypso here in Book 5 is that Odysseus understands and even welcomes the human condition. Calypso offers Odysseus immortality. She tells him that he may stay with her on her island and that she will make him an immortal. She will make him a god, in effect. Now, Greek mythology is absolutely permeated with stories of human beings who try to gain immortality. These attempts almost inevitably end in utter disaster. Perhaps the most frightening story of a human who becomes an immortal and it has a disastrous ending for him is the story of Tithonus, who was made immortal by his lover, the Dawn Goddess, but she forgot to ask for agelessness, so that Tithonus was and is immortal, can never die, will live forever, but grows forever older and older and older and older. That, I think, is a paradigmatic story to indicate that immortality is inappropriate for human beings. It does not work for human beings. The crucial dividing line between humans and gods, between those two types of entities, is that humans must die while gods cannot die. So, despite the fact that Greek myth is filled with stories of humans who want immortality, immortality almost never works for humans. Odysseus seems to understand this. When Calypso offers him what so many humans think they want beyond all else, a chance at eternal life, he rejects it. He wants humanity. He wants to be Odysseus. He wants to return home. By rejecting Calypso's offer of immortality, Odysseus is implicitly accepting and, as I said, even welcoming the human condition, even though that implies age and death, even though he has now missed 20 years out of his life, Penelope's life, Telemachus's life. Still, he prefers to return home as a human than to become an immortal but no longer truly be Odysseus. His desire to return home is, in fact, I think, precisely that, a desire to return to his full humanity and his true selfhood. In a very real sense, Odysseus is not Odysseus, away from Penelope, Telemachus, his father Laertes, Ithaca. An individual in isolation in the culture that was shown in the Homeric epics is scarcely a human individual at all. Just as Achilles' isolation, self-imposed isolation in the Iliad, cuts him off in a very real sense from being human, and he's only reintegrated into his humanity at the end of the Iliad when he re-accepts the human condition, including death. So here, Odysseus, separated from community, separated from family, separated from home, is not truly Odysseus. His choice to return home rather than staying with Calypso is a choice to return to being himself, to being Odysseus. Now, one of the most important aspects of Odysseus's character is his skill in rhetoric and persuasion. We'll see him over and over again throughout the Odyssey crafting his speech to appeal to his audience, moving what he says into a pattern in which the people he's talking to will be most receptive to it, thinking of who he's talking to before he says whatever he has to say. Our first example of this has to do specifically with what I've just been talking about, Calypso's offer of immortality and Odysseus's rejection of it. After Calypso has told him that she's going to send him home, and he's made her swear that she's not trying to trick him, they eat a meal together, and we're given the detail that he eats regular human food while she eats nectar and ambrosia, since she is, in fact, a goddess. And then Calypso reminds him that she has, in fact, offered him immortality. She says, if you knew all the troubles you'd go through before you make it home, I think you'd rather stay with me. I can make you immortal, and besides, what's so great about Penelope anyway? Do you really like her better than me? Is she really better looking? I'm a goddess, and she's just a human being. Now, Odysseus is in a very touchy situation here. It is not wise to offend, annoy, or anger a god or goddess. They can do very unpleasant things to human beings. Calypso has just said to him, why do you prefer Penelope to me? Do you really think your wife is better looking than I am? And she puts it in terms of physical appearance. Is Penelope more beautiful than I am? Odysseus has to craft his answer to that very, very carefully. He's got to think of some way to say to Calypso, I want to go home, without insulting her, without annoying her. Listen to what he actually says. Goddess and queen, do not be angry with me. I myself know that all you say is true, and that circumspect Penelope can never match the impression you make for beauty and stature. She is mortal, after all, and you are immortal and ageless. But even so, what I want and all my days I pine for is to go back to my house and see my day of homecoming. Notice what he does not say. He does not say, but Calypso, I love Penelope and I don't love you. He doesn't say, but she's my wife and you're not. He doesn't even say, but she's a human being and so am I, and I want a human being, not a goddess. He says, I want my home. He puts it in terms that Calypso can hear without an affront to her sense of dignity, without annoying her, without angering her. This is just the first very brief example of Odysseus's skill at rhetoric that I'll come back to over and over again, both in this lecture and in later lectures. So with Calypso's help, Odysseus builds a raft, she gives him provisions, wine, water, food, and he leaves her island. He sails on his raft for 18 days and is very near to the island where he will, in fact, make landfall, the island of Scheria, where he'll be met with excellent Xenia and helped on his way home. However, on the 18th day of Odysseus's journey, Poseidon sees him on his raft, and Poseidon wrecks the raft. Now, Poseidon hates Odysseus for reasons that will become abundantly obvious in a later lecture. And it's an interesting little detail about the Homeric picture of the gods that Athena had seized an opportunity when Poseidon was, so to speak, out of town to motivate Zeus to help Odysseus in the first place. Poseidon has been off in Ethiopia getting sacrifices from the Ethiopians. When the Odyssey opens, we're told that that's why Athena speaks to Zeus right then. Poseidon is away. It gives Athena a chance to do something behind Poseidon's back. In other words, these gods, though they know a great deal, are not omniscient. Poseidon doesn't know what's going on when he's off in Ethiopia. Now, we're told that Poseidon is coming back from Ethiopia. He's striding across the sea. He looks down and sees Odysseus on a raft. And Poseidon realizes that Odysseus is fated to return home. Gods cannot, or at least do not, intervene with fate to the extent of changing it. But Poseidon says to himself, well, I can't keep Odysseus from reaching Scheria and then going home, but I can make some more trouble for him. And that's what Poseidon does. He wrecks Odysseus's raft. Odysseus is left swimming for his life, literally. And after 2 nights and 2 days swimming alone on the open sea, Odysseus finally washes up on the shores of the island Scheria. When he arrives there, he is naked, battered, starved, basically more dead than alive. He's been smashed against the cliffs around the island. He's battered and bruised and torn and bloody and covered with salt from the sea and just generally in really terrible shape. When he washes up finally onto a river on the island of Scheria. He prays to the god of the river to help him, and it does. It pulls him up onto the island. Odysseus crawls out of the river, and as Book 5 of the Odyssey ends, he falls asleep, more dead than alive, in a pile of leaves. Homer uses a simile saying that Odysseus buries himself in the pile of leaves like a man will bury a burning log in a pile of ashes to preserve the fire overnight. A very vivid image of how of the little spark of life left in Odysseus at this point. Odysseus doesn't know it, but he is on an island where he will get the best possible Xenia anyone could hope for. The people of this island, the people of Scheria, are called the Phaeacians. I know it seems like they should be called the Scherians, but it's not that simple. They lived in a place called Phaeacia before they immigrated to Scheria, and they've kept their name, the Phaeacians. They are particularly dedicated to Xenia and to helping people homeward, particularly to providing ships for stranded travelers. So Odysseus is actually in very good shape. However, Odysseus is sleeping in a pile of leaves by a river. The Phaeacians are off in their city. Somehow, Odysseus has to be found by the Phaeacians before they can help him, and he's in such terrible shape that he's not just going to be able to spring up the next morning and go off looking for help himself. Athena comes to his rescue, as she has done already in the Odyssey and will do again. She is his particular patron deity, and here she engineers a very clever way for Odysseus to be found and helped. Athena appears in a dream to the young Phaeacian princess Nausicaa and inspires the young girl to go and do the family's laundry by the river where Odysseus is sleeping. Now, Nausicaa is, I think, in most readers' estimations, one of the most vividly memorable and just basically appealing characters in the Odyssey. She appears only in this one section, and she's really given much attention only in Book 6, and yet she's drawn so vividly that she stays in readers' minds even when some of the more major characters in the Odyssey perhaps have faded. She's about 14 years old, which in this culture is about the age to get married. And she's clearly anticipating getting married. No fiancé has been picked for her yet, but that doesn't matter because in a society where marriages are arranged, the important fact is that she is of an age to get married and she is thinking about her marriage. In fact, when she tells her father, the king of the Phaeacians, Alcinous, that she needs to use the wagon to go take the laundry down to the river and wash it, her father recognizes that what she's thinking about, though she doesn't come right out and say it, is washing clothes for her upcoming marriage. So Nausicaa is about to be married, but no lucky bridegroom has actually been picked yet. Nausicaa takes several slave women with her, girls of about her own age. They do the laundry and then spread the clothes out on the ground to dry. While they're waiting for the clothes to dry, they pass the time by playing a game of catch, tossing a ball back and forth. One of them misses the ball, it falls into the river, and the splash of the ball in the water awakes Odysseus. Now, upon waking, Odysseus first wonders where he is, then analyzes and reacts to his situation. When he first wakes up, he says to himself some lines that he will repeat in two other crucially important situations in the Odyssey. He wakes up and he says to himself, wondering where he is and if the people there know Xenia, he says to himself, "Ah me, what are the people whose land I have come to this time? And are they violent and savage and without justice or hospitable to strangers with a godly mind?" Notice what he's doing there. He is naming Xenia as the defining characteristic of civilization. Are these people violent and savage and without justice on the one hand, or are they hospitable to strangers? Xenia here stands for all of civilization. First, he says these lines to himself. Then he starts to ponder what exactly he should do. He is, to put it mildly, in an awkward situation. As I've already established, he's stark naked. His clothes have been torn off of him. He's bruised and battered. His hair is matted. He's covered with dried seaweed and salt and so on. And he hears the voices of the maidens, and peeking out from the shrubbery, he sees that there are a bunch of young girls out here. Now, how is he to approach them without terrifying them? How can a naked, battered, bruised, wild-looking man come bursting out of the bushes and get these girls to stand still and listen to him long enough for him to persuade them that he's not going to hurt them? It is a very tricky situation, to put it mildly. It's a scene with a lot of humor in it, I think, particularly when we're told that Odysseus ponders whether he should run up to Nausicaa, who is clearly the leader of these girls, and throw himself at his feet, at her feet, and grab her knees, or whether that might possibly anger or annoy her. I think that has got to be meant humorously, that he would even entertain the idea of bursting out of the bushes, running up to her and grabbing her. No, this is not the proper approach to take under this situation. And as he thinks it over, he decides it would be better to stand back and supplicate her with words rather than with the usual standard gestures of supplication where you do kneel in front of someone and grab their knees with your arm. The scene is humorous, and yet there is a serious underside to it. There is an implicit threat of rape in this scene. There is an implicit secondary story that could be a rape story going on here. In Greek literature and Greek mythology, the seashore is a particularly dangerous area for young girls. There are many stories about girls being raped when they were at the seashore, when they were near the coast. Young girls in this society almost never would be out without male protectors of some sort or another. Perhaps that's one reason for the association of the seacoast with rape and or abduction, that going to do the laundry near the mouth of a river is one of the few times women would be by themselves, so it's one of the few times they would be vulnerable. Also, piracy was a problem in the ancient world. Obviously, a woman on a sea coast would be vulnerable to being abducted by pirates for sexual purposes or to be sold into slavery. More generally than that, just the idea of a young girl off by herself as far as male protection is concerned, Nausicaa has her maids with her, of course, and a naked man bursting out of the bushes and running towards her, clearly there is the possibility that this could be misread as a rape scene by Nausicaa, or that if these characters were not who they are, that it could turn into exactly that sort of a situation. So Odysseus has got to find some way to persuade Nausicaa that he won't hurt her without offending her, without frightening her by saying specifically that he won't hurt her. He plucks a branch to cover his genitals and walks out of the bushes. The other girls scatter. They run away. Athena puts courage into Nausicaa's heart, and she stands and waits for Odysseus to speak to her. His interaction with Nausicaa once again demonstrates his superb skill in rhetoric and his ability to fit his words to his audience. In fact, Odysseus' speech to Nausicaa here, where he is trying to gain her favor and get her to help him, is, I think, one of the finest pieces of rhetoric in the Odyssey, and actually one of my favorite bits from the entire Odyssey. He approaches her, stands off from her, doesn't come too close to her, and remember, he's holding a branch in front of himself, and he says to her, "I am at your knees, O queen, but are you mortal or goddess? If indeed you are one of the gods who hold wide heaven, then I must find in you the nearest likeness to Artemis, the daughter of great Zeus, for beauty, figure, and stature. But if you are one among those mortals who live in this country, three times blessed are your father and the lady your mother." And he goes on to say he's never seen anything so beautiful as Nausicaa before in his life. Now, his mention, he starts out by saying, "I think you must be a goddess." His mention of the specific goddess Artemis is very carefully chosen. Artemis is one of three goddesses who remain forever virgin. The other two are Athena, the goddess of wisdom and war, and Hestia, the goddess of the hearth. But Artemis is a far more militant virgin than the other two. There are many stories about the goddess Artemis inflicting terrible punishments on men who in any way seemed to trespass upon her chastity. One story of a man who saw Artemis naked inadvertently. He didn't mean to, but he saw Artemis naked. His punishment was to be turned into a stag and torn apart by his own hunting hounds while his mind remained human and he knew what was happening to him. In other words, if ever there was a goddess that no man in his right mind would even think about approaching sexually, that goddess is Artemis. So think of what Odysseus has just done. He has said to Nausicaa, "Do not worry, I am not planning to assault you." is said, I think you must be Artemis, which carries with it the entire subtext of, and since I think you must be Artemis, I am in no way going to assault you. I am in no way going to hurt you. I'm going to keep my distance. You are in power here. But by putting it that way, by saying, I think you must be Artemis, he has avoided actually having to say, I'm not going to rape you. Because, of course, if he says that, he indicates that at least the thought was in his mind in some sense in a negative way. So he's reassured Nausicaa. He's also put in some pretty good flattery here. You look like Artemis. If you are human, your parents are incredibly blessed. I've never seen anything so beautiful in my life. He goes on to say, well, actually, I did see one thing so beautiful once before, a palm tree growing by the temple of Apollo on the island of Delos. This establishes that he's a civilized man, that he knows about Apollo, he knows about Apollo's sacred island of Delos, he's well-traveled. Then, moving along, he says, have pity, O queen. He tells her about his adventures and how he shipwrecked. Have pity, O queen. You are the first I have come to after much suffering. There is no one else that I know of here. Show me the way to the town and give me some rag to wrap me in if you had any kind of piece of cloth when you came here. The laundry is spread out drying on the ground, remember. Give me some rag to wrap me in. And then may the gods give you everything your heart longs for. May they grant you a husband and a house and sweet agreement in all things. At the end of the speech, you see, he makes it very clear that he knows precisely what she is. She's not a goddess. She's a young girl who's about the right age to be married. When he gets to the end of his speech, after he's called her goddess, then he's called her queen, then finally he says, may the gods give you what you want. And of course, what you want is a husband, a house of your own, a really good marriage. So he has established his credentials. He's made it clear that he is superbly civilized, that he knows exactly how to act, and he's done it all in an extremely carefully crafted speech that appeals to her and in no way threatens her. She responds in kind. She knows Xenia. She knows how to help him. She gives him clothing. She gives him food, and she calls her attendants to help Odysseus bathe. Now, in the culture of the Homeric poems, women bathe men. Men sit in a tub and women come in and bathe them. In book 3 of the Odyssey, Telemachus was bathed by Nestor's youngest daughter. So there's nothing at all odd about Nausicaa offering her maids as help for Odysseus to take a bath in the river. And yet Odysseus says no. He says, I'll bathe myself. I would be ashamed to appear naked in front of these young girls. I think that, again, is an indication of just how delicate he is being here. In this situation, with no men around, better not to have any contact with these young girls at all. Athena beautifies Odysseus after he bathes, and Nausicaa comments to her maidens that she would be happy to marry him if only he would stay on Scheria. As he walks out of the river, Athena has made him look younger and more beautiful, and Nausicaa looks at him and says, well, he looks much better than he did a few minutes ago. She, as book 6 ends, Nausicaa gives Odysseus instructions about going to the palace in Scheria to approach her parents and ask for help. And in her speech, she indicates that she is no less skilled in rhetoric than Odysseus is. She tells him, start out following me into the city. Walk along with my wagon. But when we get to the city gates, she says, hold back. Don't come into the city with me. Wait till I've gone in, and then you come in by yourself and ask someone directions. Because otherwise, she says, someone who saw us together might say, who is this large and handsome stranger whom Nausicaa has with her? And where did she find him? Surely he is to be her husband. And then she goes on quoting this fictitious somebody who might say, well, maybe this is a god who's come down to marry her, or maybe she found him herself somewhere else. And that's actually a good thing because she pays no heed to her own Phaeacian neighbors, although many of these and the best ones court her. So they will speak, she says. And that would be a scandal against me, and I myself would disapprove of a girl who acted so. That is, without the goodwill of her dear father and mother, making friends with a man before being formally married. She says to the man she has just made friends with before, without her parents knowing it. Think of what she has done here. She's told him her name. She's told him that she is being courted by all sorts of really noble men but doesn't like any of them. She's told him that she is very willing to marry him if he's willing to marry her. And she's wrapped that all up in saying, I would disapprove of anyone who said this to a man. It's a wonderful, wonderful little speech. She has put her proposal of marriage to him in a way that leaves him able to refuse her without having to refuse her. He doesn't have to say to her, I don't want to marry you, or I'm already married, or anything else, because she's never proposed marriage at all. She said exactly what she would not do. So as book six ends, now Sicca'a has made her interest in Odysseus clear. She has also helped him. She's provided Xenia for him. She's told him to go to her parents' palace to get more and more complete Xenia. And as we move on into the next lecture, we will examine how the people of Scheria, particularly now Sicca'a's parents, entertain Odysseus royally and do, in fact, finally send him on his way. We'll also see Odysseus begin his own first-person narrative of his wanderings from Troy to Calypso's island.